Good morning. Well, you think you know how the week is going to go. And then yesterday, bam, a cyber attack on the HSE computer system.
We have been the subject of a very significant major ransomware attack. It's quite a very sophisticated attack, and that will be just a kind of standard attack. So it's very sophisticated. It is impacting all of our national and the local systems that would be involved in all of our core services. We did become aware of it during the night, and we've been obviously acting on it straight away. The immediate priority is obviously to contain this, but it is what we call a kind of human-operated ransomware attack, where they would seek to get access to data and obviously, you know, seek a ransom for it. So it's quite a significant one, quite a serious one. We've taken a precautionary measure to shut down a lot of our major systems to protect them. We have sought and have already got the support of the national security and IT systems. You know, so it's we are working with all of our major IT security providers, and the national security cyber team are involved. They have been alerted. You know, so that would be the major state supports, including Garda, Defence Forces, and third-party cyber support teams.
HSE Chief Executive Paul Reid on Morning Ireland. Also on the line was cybersecurity expert Brian Honan.
Let's start with the basics. What is a ransomware attack?
A ransomware attack is where criminals use a computer virus to infect your computers. And once they trigger the virus, it encrypts or scrambles all your data so that you can't access it. And then they demand a ransom, an extortion fee from you to give you the password to recover your data from. So it's an attack where they make your information unavailable and literally hold it to ransom.
Later on the news at 1, we learned more about the nature of this attack from operations manager with the HSE, Anne O'Connor, and she described it as a zero-day threat.
What does that mean?
My understanding is that this is a brand new variant. So the zero day, there is no warning. We don't know what it is. We don't know where it has come from. And that is what everybody is working with us on. It has come across all of our virus protection systems, and people are now working to determine what it is. So zero day, I understand, means that there is no previous known experience of this.
And while backup systems may be used, if these two are compromised, what are the available options? Back to Brian Honan.
You know, as I said, hopefully the backups have not been impacted and the data can be restored from that. If the backups have been impacted, then the options are to not pay the ransom and rebuild your systems from scratch as best you can. Or unfortunately, a decision may have to be made whether or not to pay the ransom to try to get the data back. But we should be very wary. You are dealing with criminals. By their nature, they're not the most trustworthy people in the world. And there's no guarantee, even if you pay the ransom, that you will get your data back, or that if you pay the ransom, that there's no additional costs or impact on the information that as a result of the attack.
And our health and social care IT systems have been severely disrupted in what was described by Minister of State for Public Procurement and E-Government, Oisín Smith, as possibly the most significant cybercrime attack on the Irish state. Just after 5 o'clock yesterday, Dr. Colm Henry, Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE, joined Cormac on Drive Time.
I know the initial response to contain this and protect data, personal data, is to shut down the systems, as you say. And part of the response, I believe, is to partially reopen the systems in a graduated way. How long will the disruption go on for?
Cormac, the most recent information in the past, it will take a number of days. It is, as I say, an unprecedented situation in terms of its seriousness, of its impact, and of the scale and scope of the potential harm. And as such, the advice we're getting from those same experts we're working with is that given how serious this is, it's going to take a number of days before we can safely begin to reopen those IT systems on which our healthcare services rely.
We could have done without that one. Housing continued to dominate the news this week, and not that we needed reminding. This crisis is nothing new. In fact, in 2019, it had caught the eye of the then UN Special Rapporteur on Housing, Leilani Farha. She had written directly to our government about her concerns, and she spoke to Sarah on Wednesday's Drive Time about that letter.
2 years ago, you wrote to the government, as I say, expressing concern about, and I quote, the practice of adopting laws and policies which treat housing as a commodity and undermine the enjoyment of housing as a human right. Now, I wonder what led to you writing that letter at the time. Why were you concerned?
I was concerned because I had heard from people in Ireland, I had visited Dublin, that housing was unaffordable, that it had been financialized. In other words, the big capital investors had come in and were buying up properties, contributing to the unaffordability, and that homelessness was also a real issue, as well as even overcrowding, and that there just simply wasn't enough deeply affordable housing for the people of Ireland. And so I felt I should use my position to ask the government of Ireland about that. And so that's why I sent that letter.
And Farha warned about something called the financialization of housing, where property is a safe bet for large investment firms. And far from Ireland being a special Caithmile Fáilte kind of place to invest, no. As the saying goes, it's not personal. This is a global practice where all that matters is the bottom line.
The largest private equity firm is Blackstone. They buy en masse. I just heard that they bought thousands of units in San Diego yesterday. They did that after the global financial crisis. This really emerged after the global financial crisis, including in Ireland, as a model, purchasing many, many units all at once using a financial instrument called real estate investment trusts that have very favorable tax rates, often paying no taxes at all, no capital gains tax, no corporate tax, no taxes on rent rolls. So it is very common and obviously has a dominance in Ireland.
And although we're being told time and time again that the issue here is one of supply or rather lack thereof, Farha was not so sure.
You know, Ireland is the perfect example of how supply does not answer a housing crisis. That is exactly the problem with what happened in Maynooth, with 135 of 170 units being purchased by a single buyer investor, right? So how does that help? They're going to turn those into rentals. Those then become an income stream for the investment company, and those will become unaffordable. Mm. So supply didn't do any good in Maynooth in that case. And now there are young families in Maynooth who can't perhaps access those homes and build their own equity.
Liani Farha, former UN Special Rapporteur on Housing, as heard on Drive Time. And while the politicians pored over the policy, as well they should, we also heard the voices of those for whom closing your own front door may forever be a pipe dream. On the News at One, Cian McCormack spoke to health journalist June Shannon.
I am 49. I'm living in a rented accommodation still. The reasons for living in a rented accommodation still is that And after we got married, we spent €21,000 on IVF treatment. Then we were lucky enough to have our child. When she arrived, there was lots of joy, but there was also childcare costs. So as a result, we're still renting in our rented accommodation with no real hope of being able to afford to buy a home because all our money is going into rent and childcare. So there's no way to save for even a deposit. There is this kind of narrative in the media that everyone who is in searching for a home is, you know, between 25 and 30 and living at home, mum and dad. That's not the case. There are lots of people like me in their mid-40s, late-40s, early-50s, who, because of certain circumstances in their lives, haven't been able to buy a house until now. I can't see it happening unless we win the lotto.
And while buying in a couple with two incomes might be daunting, what about if you're single with just the one pay packet coming in? Ryan spoke to one such person, Jen Gannon, and she felt that if you were trying to buy on your own, you might as well forget it.
I just can't do this. It's actually impossible.
And talk to me about that impossibility.
I mean, even to be able to, you know, put together a €30,000 deposit, and you'd have to have a salary of over 70,000 to be able to try and do it. And I just think when you're renting and the rents are so exorbitant, it's very hard to try and just live your life and pay your rent, and at the same time trying to save is just out of this world. It just doesn't feel like it's something that's possible for a lot of single people. And you're thinking, you know, to yourself, the older that you get, are you going to have to be living with other people while you're in your 40s and 50s and, you know, with strangers, with roommates? And it just doesn't seem like a viable situation. As single people, you're never in the mix of the conversation at all, because it does feel like the government are like, you know, an old your relative saying to you, would you not ever settle down, for God's sake? You know, you're just not in that conversation at all. It's not a permanent state.
Do you feel that the government is kind of saying, you know, don't be so silly trying to buy a place on your own. Just find a nice fella or a girl or whatever you need and settle down together and sort that out?
Yeah, I do. I think really? There is this underlying conservatism in Irish society. I mean, we say that we're a modern society, but I do think there is this conservatism, this idea that the family is sacred and, you know, that you're some kind of overgrown teenager if you're not in a relationship, and that is just not a permanent state, that you will find someone. So I do think when it comes to wanting a place on your own, they just think it's laughable.
So reluctantly couple up or prepare to label the milk in your fridge right into your 50s. Grim. That was Jen Gannon with Ryan. Violence in the Middle East and in Gaza was a story that grew as the week progressed. But what had led to such a drastic escalation? On Wednesday's Late Debate, Katie asked this of Professor Paul Rogers of Bradford University.
Tell us why this time the stakes are raised.
It has been developing for several weeks now, and I think the origins, of course, was the case brought by potential Jewish settlers to take over a Palestinian settlement, Sheikh Jarrah, in East Jerusalem, quite near the city itself, not far off. And this was seen by Palestinians as almost a kind of ethnic cleansing. It hadn't actually happened, but there were a lot of disturbances, a lot of anger. There were claims of harassment by settlers. There were counterclaims of Palestinians essentially rioting. And it came to a head, I think, very strongly when the police decided to intervene very forcefully and to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is probably the third most holy place in the whole of Islam. And that led to very strong feelings on the Palestinian Arab side. And that's where the Gaza situation developed with the initial rocket strikes two or three nights ago.
Earlier on the News at One, Brian had spoken to Israeli Ambassador to Ireland, Ofir Kariv, who said that he believed his country's response was self-defence against what he described as a Hamas terrorist attack. And he insisted Israel did not target civilians. However, Brian Dobson pressed him on the proportionality of that response.
You say Israel doesn't target civilians, but the Geneva Convention specifically says that parties to a conflict, and I quote, must at all times distinguish between the civilian population and combatants. Now, where's the evidence that Israel has made that distinction between those who are civilians, entirely innocent of any participation in conflict, and those who are combatants?
The vast majority of people killed in Gaza are Hamas terrorists and Hamas members. Unfortunately, sometimes, especially in dense populated areas like Gaza, some others are going in harm's way. Israel is doing it at its utmost to ensure that only terrorists are being targeted. There's another important issue that just, yes, if I may, an important here that has to do with civilians. Around 30% of the rockets fired by Hamas and the Islamic Jihad fall inside Gaza itself. And we know for sure that quite a few casualties there, including children,
right,
were killed by the fire of Hamas and Gaza and the Islamic Jihad. Right.
But 49 dead overnight, it's reported from Gaza. 12 of those were children. So how can you know that most of those who are casualties are Hamas?
We know exactly who we target. The Israeli...
Do you know who you kill, Ambassador?
Usually, yes. Not always. Again, it's very complicated. And I think this is where we see the double war crime of Hamas, which first fires at indiscriminately at Israeli population, civil population centers, and at the same time uses its own population as shields, as human shields.
And while people in Israel have also been killed, there have been significantly more fatalities in Gaza.
Yehuda Sepp, you're here to account for the actions of Israel, and we know that Gaza is one of the most crowded places on the planet. 2 million mm-hmm. people in an area smaller than the size of County Louth. And if you launch attacks on this sort of scale, on the sort of buildings, and people will have seen the images of these buildings being collapsed, it's inevitable, isn't it, that there will be significant civilian casualties?
I've been speaking this morning and last night with my family back in Israel, with my son that had to go in and out of the safe room, with my wife and son that had to go to rush for safety at 3 o'clock in the morning because of incoming rockets. Israel is obliged to protect its own citizens. Hamas is using the Palestinians as human shields.
Yeah,
but we are defending our citizens,
yes, but
trying to minimize as much as possible the civilian casualties on the other side.
Yeah. No one,
it's
no
very
one,
difficult to say, okay, but those questions, yes, have to go to the Palestinian,
yes,
side.
But Minister, Ambassador, nobody would want to see a family terrorized in the way you've described your own family's experience. But your family has a safe room to go to. There are no shelters in Gaza. There's nowhere for people to hide.
My family has a safe room to rush to because my government uses its resources to defend our citizens. If you take all the resources that came into Gaza in the last years, including building materials, tons, thousands of tons, and Hamas put those into attack tunnels instead of defending its own
citizens, this is
the result.
Yeah, but those materials are now blockaded. There is no access to concrete and other materials like that.
A lot of those materials, large, huge quantities of those materials have been coming into Gaza in the last years.
Israeli Ambassador to Ireland Ofir Kariv on Wednesday's News at 1. And neither side is backing down. Later, the 5 o'clock news bulletin brought us this.
The leader of Hamas, Ismail Haniyeh, said the militant group which governs Gaza would fight back.
If they want to escalate, the resistance is ready. If they want to stop, the resistance is ready. If they want to move out of Jerusalem, the resistance is ready. This is the message we give to everyone.
And the Israeli military have also intensified their attacks on Gaza, with the army looking at the option of a ground offensive and fighting on the streets in Israel between Arab and Jewish communities. Because Israel restricts entry of foreign journalists to Gaza, many of the voices on the radio have not been reporting from Gaza itself. However, yesterday, Morning Ireland reporter Jonah Sullivan spoke to Nachala Shawa in Gaza about how her family were coping.
I live with my husband and my two daughters. They're 4 and 6 years old.
What have the last few days been like for you as a family?
It's difficult to describe because it goes like different phases of the day in between the bombardment and like airstrikes from Navy, Israeli Navy shelling and all that, and all the time in between, just trying to manage our stress, trying to manage my daughter's anxiety, because now she's really terrified that whenever she hears any little sound, she thinks it's an airstrike, and then she runs, and sometimes she screams. And then we go to the window to check on the smoke. Where is the smoke coming from? It's heartbreaking and it's very difficult. And what can you explain to a 6-year-old?
From yesterday's Morning Ireland. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The Norse myths were the focus of Culture File with Heather O'Donoghue, Professor of Old Norse Icelandic Literature at Oxford.
The Old Norse myths are stories about the gods, first of all, the gods who peopled Asgard, Ásgarður, in the Old Norse form, and they were the names that we know, really, the names Thor, Odin, Freya. The interesting thing about the Old Norse gods is that they were not eternal and they were not perfect. So they were a curious kind of reflection of humanity. they were fallible. They experienced sadness. Odin, for instance, was untrustworthy, an oath breaker. Thor had a kind of what we might call now an anger management problem, and he had a very short fuse and was liable to violence. So there are lots of stories about the gods, but the great kind of centre of Old Norse mythology, oddly a centre that's the end of Old Norse mythology in one sense, is what's called Ragnarök, which means something like the judgment of the gods or what the gods deserved. It was slightly mistranslated, actually, as the twilight of the gods, and that's what gives us Wagner's Götterdämmerung, the dimming of the gods. And Ragnarök is the time when the gods, as it were, get what was coming to them, if you want to take a kind of moral line. But it's an apocalyptic view of it's the end of the world when the world will kind of implode and mountains will split apart and the gods will face their equal and opposite adversary, a monster. So Thor will meet the world serpent, the monstrous great serpent that holds the world together.
And these stories reminded us that everything has an ending.
One of the figures, one of the great symbols in Old Norse mythology, is the symbol of the world tree, Yggdrasil, this huge world tree. And one of the first signs of Ragnarök, the end of the world, the Norse apocalypse, is that the tree will begin to tremble and will begin to creak. And, you know, I mean, real old trees do that. Trees, you know, the ancient trees that we can see do that. And if there's a storm, you know, these great symbols of longevity and stability begin to start to show. And that's the great thing about Old Norse myth, the idea that nothing lasts forever. That everything has a kind of organic lifespan.
Culture File. Nothing lasts forever. Something the duck population know all too well.
So if you take a typical female duck, let's say she lives for about 10 years. If she has, let's say, on average, a dozen ducklings each year for 10 years in a row, that's 120 chicks. Ultimately, only two of those will survive to replace their parents in the
only
population.
Only two, like, of 120?
Only two. Yeah, we're talking mortality
less
rate.
Of 98%.
Yep, more or less. Yeah, it's absolutely massive. Yeah,
wow.
And there's many reasons for that. There's lots of predatory birds and fish that will feed on them. So you'll have birds like grey herons, gulls will feed on them as well. You often have things like rats will grab them, pike will come and get them from below, and other predatory fish. Also, starvation. You know, it's a really survival of the fittest. So we're making life even harder for them when it's already hard enough.
Golly, Niall Hatch of Birdwatch Ireland speaking to Ray after a spate of duckling thefts. Yes. Duckling thefts, not a phrase you'd think you'd be hearing too often. But apparently duckies are the new TikTok accessory and on sale for as little as a fiver.
Are they easy to catch?
Excuse me?
Well, in some cases they would be, especially when they're very young, because they tend not to really understand much about danger. And for people who are using nets or whatever, they might find that relatively easy.
Easy to catch, maybe, but Niall Hatch was not skirting around the issues facing the wee ducklings.
What will happen in most cases is that, first of all, this duckling, it will experience stress, even if it's not clear that that's what's happening to it. It's out of its natural environment. It's not reacting the way that it normally would. It's missing its mother. They have this very strong bond. They imprint on their mother from the second they come out of the egg. They'll follow the first creature that they see, which in most cases is their mother. So when you see captive ducks that are reared in captivity, they've often imprinted on a human being. So they almost think of themselves as being human and they'll follow them. That's not the case for wild ducklings. They'll be pining for their mothers. Obviously, people may not mean any harm, but they won't be able to feed this bird successfully. People, have no doubt, are feeding them bread, thinking that's a good food for ducklings. In fact, that's a death sentence for ducklings. Too much bread, there's not enough protein in that, there's not enough by way of vitamins and minerals. It's just pure carbohydrates, really. They won't develop, they'll suffer malnutrition and they'll die. And even if by some miracle they do survive, they won't have learned how to cope in the wild with predators. They haven't had their mother to show them how to behave as ducks, so they have no futures, unfortunately.
Ay, ay, ay. Now, we are always on Matt Damon watch here, many. But 7-year-old Rourke O'Connella got closer than most. He's a Gaelic ambassador for Cruinne an Óg and an actor who starred with the Damon in a film called The Last Duel. But what was Matty like in the flesh? Rourke told all to Fionnuala in Yachtan.
Hi, how are ya?
Very cute. God, you'd think he'd have the cupola focal after all his time here. On Thursday, the death was announced of Seamus Dean, one of Ireland's foremost writers and critics, and general editor of the Field Day anthology of Irish writing. On Arena, one of the voices paying tribute to Dean's contribution to Irish life was Fintan O'Toole.
I think he should be remembered, first of all, as a great writer. You know, that's what he was. He was a writer. And it was the writing that made him so rich, so vibrant. You know, he loves writing good sentences. And that made him think. It made it pushed him. And therefore, he respected that craft. And he respected what it was to try to think your way through things. And what Dean did was that in a period when it was very polarized in Irish intellectual life, it was very, very difficult, and he got a huge amount of stick, some of it well-deserved. But, you know, he raised the bar in terms of saying, if we're going to talk about these things, we have to talk about them with depth, with consideration, with a sense of history, and we have to write about them well, you know. And nobody, even if you completely disagreed with him, nobody ever came away from reading him or from meeting him without being invigorated and without thinking, I have to raise my game. If I'm going to take this guy on, I better be good.
And here is Seamus Dean reading from his award-winning autobiographical novel, Reading in the Dark.
Stairs, February 1945. On the stairs there was a clear, plain silence. It was a short staircase, 14 steps in all, covered in lino from which the original pattern had been polished away to the point where it had the look of a faint memory. 11 steps took you to the turn of the stairs with the cathedral and the sky always hung in the window frame. 3 more steps took you onto the landing, about 6 feet long. Don't move, my mother said from the landing. Don't cross that window. I was on the 10th step. She was on the landing. I could have touched her. There's something there between us, a shadow. Don't move. I had no intention. I was enthralled, but I could see no shadow. There's somebody there, somebody unhappy. Go back down the stairs, son. I retreated one step. How'll you get down? I'll stay a while and it will go away. How do you know? I'll feel it gone. What if it doesn't go? It always does. I'll not be long. I stood there, looking up at her. I loved her then. She was small and anxious, but without real fear.
The voice of the late Seamus Dean, as heard on Arena. On Sunday, Brendan spoke to Professor Richard Dawkins about celebrating science and his latest publication, Books Do Furnish a Life, Reading and Writing Science. And it was a conversation that was wide-ranging and very interesting indeed. Brendan asked the committed atheist about faith, comfort and truth.
Would you say that, like, whatever gets them through the night, if it helps them to have a better quality of life, that then that's okay for them?
Within limits, I would say that. But yeah. I as a scientist, I do value truth, and therefore I'm not sure that I'm that enthusiastic about getting you through the night if it's downright false.
Okay.
And for Dawkins, life and science provided wonder enough.
The truth is beautiful. And as the centuries go by, what we're learning about the truth gets even more beautiful. I mean, it is a great privilege to live in the 21st century, to live after Darwin, after Einstein, after quantum mechanics, and to revel in the beauty of understanding the universe in which we live and the life of which we're a part.
All very interesting, and even as you might expect. But then, one particular issue came up, and this is how Brendan O'Connor handled it.
And I'll be completely honest with you and say I have a kind of an interest in this myself, and I promise you, I'm not taking any offence by it or anything. I'm just curious about it, okay? So I want to ask you about the... You got involved in a Twitter interaction with a woman who said she would be faced with a real ethical dilemma if she became pregnant with a baby with Down syndrome. You tweeted, abort it and try again. It would be immoral to bring it into the world if you have the choice. Now, so you're speaking to somebody who did bring someone like that into the world, okay, but let's put that aside. I'm interested in how do you think it is immoral to bring someone with Down syndrome into the world?
I think that once you have a child with Down syndrome, you love it, you cherish it, everybody does, that's well known, I wouldn't deny that for one single moment. But before it's born, the vast number of people who take an amniocentesis and is diagnosed with Down syndrome, as a matter of fact, do abort it. This is just a fact. In Denmark...
I would accept that fact and I wouldn't judge anyone's choice about that, but why is it immoral not to abort it?
Well... that was probably putting it a bit too strongly, but given that the amount of suffering in the world probably does not go down, probably does go up, compared to having another child who doesn't have Down syndrome, then that's what I meant.
Okay.
But I want to stress over and over again that people, I was of course not suggesting that people who already have a Down syndrome child don't love it, shouldn't love it.
Absolutely. I didn't take that from it.
I'm sure you didn't, but many people did, and I think that was the reason it got controversial.
What I'm interested in is how do you know that it increases the amount of suffering in the world to bring in a child with Down syndrome into the world?
I don't know it for certain. It seems to me to be plausible that if a child has any kind of disability, then you probably would increase the amount of happiness in the world more by having another child instead.
Do you think, but you have no reason for knowing that?
I have no direct evidence, no.
You're such a scientific, logical person that I thought that you could possibly have some logical backup to it. So, do you know anyone with Down syndrome?
Not intimately, no.
Okay, yeah.
And that steady, measured, analytical line of questioning continued.
Everyone has their own experience of it, and possibly my experience would be that you're not necessarily right, and I think a lot of people would think you're not necessarily right.
But look, anyway. I'm sure that you love your child.
Oh yeah, nothing to do with that. I'm not having an emotional discussion with you here. Simply having a logical discussion with you. You said that you would increase the amount of suffering in the world. I was just asking you in a logical way how you know that. You believe that if we can check for deafness or blindness or any other disabilities, that we should, and look, I'm not criticizing you here. You think we should abort those children, those fetuses.
Well, it's a choice that the parent has.
But do you think it would be immoral for them not to do it?
Let's leave out the immoral.
No, but you brought immoral into it.
Okay, well, I take that back. Okay. I think it would be wise and sensible to abort a child which had a serious disability, which was diagnosed early in pregnancy.
Okay.
And I suspect that almost everybody does that in practice.
Okay. And there's one other thing I would say on it is purely, again, on the basis of rationality. You know, children who are so-called perfect can cause terrible suffering in the world as well. But I suppose we have no way of checking, have we?
No, of course.
Professor Richard Dawkins with Brendan on Sunday. Quite the interview. Back in a bit. Welcome back. The start of the week was all about the hairdos and, of course, pennies. But not everyone is lacing up the runners to hit the shops with gusto or get back into the social whirl. No, some people have rather, whisper it, enjoyed the lockdown, the less frenetic pace, the not seeing people. And getting back out there again? Not so keen. In fact, downright anxious. Dr. Sabina Brennan, psychologist and neuroscientist, joined Claire with some advice.
I think it's perfectly normal to feel anxious. And I think a lot of people are feeling both excited and anxious. And they're not all that different in a way. You know, the stress response, has a similar sensation, you know, those butterflies in your tummy when it just kicks off. But anxiety is a normal response to stressors, but manage it steps at a time. I mean, back in the first lockdown, about 6 weeks in, you know, when we really hadn't gone anywhere, you know, and it was still that very heightened state of fear. We have adapted somewhat, and in some ways that's good for our stress levels. In other ways, you know, it can also allow us to drop our guard a little bit. It's important to rationalise your fears and to follow, you know, the guidance to the letter of the law. But I would dip in a step at a time. If you are feeling that you might get overwhelmed, a little at a time, and reintroduce as many of your old routines as possible, as they will help you to feel comfortable. Now, at the moment, for a lot of people, their emotional brain, their amygdala, their fear centers is actually shutting down or shouting down their rational brain. So I think that we actually have to take active and be very proactive about, you know, listening to our thinking and changing it up and saying, actually, that's not rational in this situation.
Irrational maybe, but that reluctance to return to life as normal was echoed in an email into Ryan from a man already missing lockdown, cosy in his cosies, which in turn prompted this from Vivian Guerin, former director of the Irish Probation Service.
This reminds me of what many people feel serving prison sentences. They call it gate fever as they get nearer to their release date. And it's a feeling of positive excitement about the prospect of getting out of jail, combined with an underlying fear of how they will cope, and if they will cope, as well as, believe it or not, fear of the loss of the familiar, what they have become used to in custody. This is the result of the process of institutionalisation. No matter what our current or ongoing situation, the prospect of change, even to a better future, can cause anxiety. All change involves loss, and loss involves pain. And we can all become institutionalised in one way or another and need help, and most of all, understanding in how we navigate the changes.
Gate fever. Now that's one to remember. Meanwhile, over on the book show, Heretics, Rick and Afric O'Connell were talking about falling out of love with reading. And if you did, how best to get yourself back in the groove?
If you're going to start a new book, you need to give it a chance. You need to do 3 chapters in one sitting. Make sure you wait for a time when you know you're going to be on your own. You know you're not going to be interrupted. Your phone is in, you know, you turn your phone off and you just go for it. Give it 3 chapters. Give it a fair crack. You'll have a good feel of it around that time and it'll set you up to set up the habit again.
I will add to that. Take your phone, switch it off, put it in another room where you can't see it. That works for me.
And what also works for them is quitting.
This might be the key one. Normalise giving up on a book.
This is so important because it feels like the last thing that you should do. It feels like a sin. But sometimes things just don't work for people. You're wasting your time. You're only going to enjoy reading less if you're struggling through it. So absolutely, if it's not working for you, put it down.
Normally for me, it's 100, 150 pages. I gave up on one recently after 19. There is no problem with this. Just walk away from it. It's not for you.
Shocking. To the bitter end. Joyless, but complete. Slang, idioms and the general way of carrying on was confusing Claire.
I'm from Leash, as people may know, but I find in the West when people meet you, they go, well. And I see that as a question. I don't really know what the answer is. Like, what is the answer to well with a question mark at the end?
You just say, well, man.
Okay. Write that down. Write that down for the next time.
It also depends on who you're talking to. Like, if you're approaching a gang of people leaning against a wall, you might say, how are them in? How are the lads? You know, how's it going? Or, indeed, not a bad day for it, whatever it might be.
What
you
is
know?
It? Yeah.
Colm O'Regan, who was joined by fellow comedians Martin Beans-Ward and Nuala McKeever to give Claire and, frankly, the rest of us a bit of a schooling. Take this example from Martin.
Colm's at home fiend, but the Gammy Fiend's from Cork. They're whitting the can't vegan from the Minkery. So so basically, Colm's a very nice guy, but the fiends from Cork are whitting the can't, which would be they'd be talking the can't or speaking the can't, and vegan from the Minkery, so that'd be stealing from the travellers. Ooh. Controversial.
Would you say the sentence for me again, Martin?
Are you repeating the libel, Martin, is what we're saying?
I'm putting it into the thing at the beginning, you know. The Gammy Fiends are the Tome Fiends from Cork or Whitten the Cant or the Shelta, and they're Beagan from the Minkery. So that would be they're speaking the Cant, which is Shelta, or the language of the travellers, and they're Beagan from the Minkery. And Minkery is the actual Shelter word to describe travellers, because, of course, travellers were much more than nomadic people. So the actual all-encompassing word to describe the community would actually be Minkery. And in some communities with, or some areas of the country, we would say Pavi and Beagan. So Beagan is to steal. So the Gammy Fiends from Cork are Whitten de Cant and the Shelter, and they're Beagan from the Minkery.
Tricky. But column two had his own rules.
I remember when I was starting out in comedy and I'd say I was from Cork, and then somebody from, you know, Blackrock would say, oh, Langer. And I'd be like, that word, take that word out of your, out of your so-called dumb mouth. It just does not fit. Like, you know, that's obviously I'm being facetious. You can, of course, say it, but I will call the guards.
Ooh, might Colm have been referring to one famous Southside high-no drinking rugby yaw, Rosso Cowell Kelly? The creator Paul Howard spoke to Miriam on Sunday, and he talked about the origin of the character and its unlikely fans. Fans who might not quite be getting it.
Ironically, and I know this and most people know that, but it, like, the people you set out to satirise, right, to really target almost out of an anger, was it a surprise that they were the very people who became your readers?
Yeah, it was a complete surprise. I never expected that at all. The column started in the Sunday Tribune in 1998. And, you know, I've said it before, I had a huge chip on my shoulder about class. And, you know, that whole rugby school thing just bothered me, you know, and the whole rugby culture thing. And I set out to satirize that, to send that up. And then I think Ross then became more about the Celtic Tiger than about rugby specifically. And I realized along the way that the people I was sending up were the people who were reading it. You know, they were getting a kick out of it. And that was a huge surprise to me. Blackrock College itself, I mean, I'm there probably four times a year, you know, talking to transition year kids, reading to the night study students, giving the senior cup team their pep talk before they play Clontos in the senior cup. None of this was ever part of the plan, you know. And I say to Alan McGinty, the principal of Blackrock, all the time, Alan, this is not, you know, I'm sending them up. Do they not get, you know? And he said, no, they do, but they kind of have a sense of irony about it. So that's much to my relief.
And another writer who nails the vernacular is Roddy Doyle. He spoke to Sarah about his Barrytown trilogy ahead of a documentary on RTÉ Telly tomorrow.
I mean, what I love about street language or slang is really the notion that there's a bunch of young girls somewhere in Dublin and they're laughing because one of them has just made up a word to describe something, you know? And that word may well be gone by tomorrow, but it may well still be in the air in 20 or 30 or 40 years' time. And a bit like Shakespeare, some playwright will hear it and will know it because he grew up or she grew up with it, and it'll get into a play. And in a way, there's something brilliant about that.
And it's now a staggering 30 years since the film of The Commitments was released.
I haven't seen the film since they were released.
Really?
Yeah.
Why not?
I tend to run away from a piece of work when I'm finished. And particularly with the films, the first couple, I thought I was in danger of being defined as the man who broke the commitment for the rest of my life. And I couldn't go anywhere but somebody would put on Mustang Sally.
Okay.
You know, anywhere I went, Mustang Sally. And it's the one song I hate. I can't stand it.
Oh, well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week. Oh, we wouldn't. Would we? Yeah, we would. Sorry, Roddy. Mustang Sally, guess you've been